Central Time, I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump said the trade war with China will push companies to bring factory jobs back to the United States. Is that actually happening? An economist joins us to tackle that question coming up. First, when you think about the Midwest, what typically comes to mind? For many around the country, they might think of rolling hills or flat areas, scenic landscapes, and farms. And more often than not, they think of people who are white. But the Midwest is not just white and rural. There are cities, bustling suburbs, and more diversity than many people think. But this is a theme that played out a couple weeks ago following the last round of Democratic debates in Detroit on television and on Twitter. And stereotypes about the Midwest could play a big role in the 2020 elections. Our next guest is here to talk about the role the Midwest plays in politics and what candidates and lawmakers get wrong about the region. Philip Chen is an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into this latest coming out of the Democratic debates and stuff, do you see this like the national media, national politicians, maybe because Iowa is the first state, the images, you know, corn and the state fair and tractors?
Absolutely. I mean, I think part of it is sort of the Iowa factor, right? And then I think the other part of it is just what we sort of conjure as images, the way that symbols represent, certain symbols represent certain things in not just American politics, but American society. So when we think of the Midwest, we often, like you said, think about rolling hills, farms, and predominantly historically, not as much anymore, but historically, that has been a white-dominated area and profession.
Does that skew politics? Does it skew what politicians say to try to sell themselves in the Midwest if they ignore what's really going on and just focus on that one image?
I think it does. I think the other thing we have to remember is that the parties are talking to different constituencies in the Midwest, right? So whereas the Democratic Party has done very well in urban centers and increasingly in suburban areas, the Republican Party has done very well in rural areas, and those are different demographics that they're talking to. And so the way that candidates talk about the Midwest, about this, yes, there's kind of this idealized Midwestern farmer mentality that is part of all political discourse. But when we're talking about specific targets of voters, we are seeing different constituencies that the parties are targeting.
Let's go to the debates now in Detroit. Following the last round, NBC talked to former Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill to get her take on how the presidential hopefuls performed. She pointed out Ohio Representative Tim Ryan's concerns with Medicare for all. Here's a bit of what she said.
America is generally not as far along the left line as Bernie and Elizabeth. Free stuff from the government does not play well in the Midwest because they're just convinced that they're never the ones getting the free stuff. You know, they're working really hard and they can't afford to retire.
As she went on to say that Donald Trump fed on some of those insecurities and looked to scapegoat people, Mexicans and Muslims, among others, for issues facing people in the Midwest. Some people have looked at those remarks and said this is a stereotype of this. So maybe a particular constituency in the Midwest, yeah, is fairly described there, but maybe not the whole deal.
Right. I think that's a fair way to think about it. The other thing is what she's really talking about isn't an objective point of view about how much money is going into rural America or to the Midwest versus how much is coming out in taxes. We know Kathy Kramer right here on campus at the University of Wisconsin has wrote an entire book about this that shows that actually rural areas take in more in services than they do than they pay in taxes. So it's she's not talking about it in that sense. She's talking about it in this kind of sense of what does it mean to be self-reliant, to be an individual, and to sort of be self-supporting. And in that sense, the rhetoric around Medicare for all strikes at that at what she's getting there, even though the statistics around tax monies and services coming in and going out don't match up to that idea.
Talking about the national image of the Midwest and how it plays into politics, Democratic and Republican, you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think national politicians, the national media gets wrong or gets right about Wisconsin and the Midwest in general? Philip Chen is with us from Beloit College. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234. One, two, three, four. Does urban, the urban Midwest, get overlooked in national politics?
I guess defined overlooked is a hard thing. I mean, does it get overlooked by the Democratic Party? No, it's where it's the core base of support in states like Illinois. You know, 60%, I think, about of voters in Minnesota reside in either an urban or a suburban area. So they're not overlooked as in terms of who's being targeted as far as turning out voters. But they aren't. Urban centers are not included in the sort of colloquial images, the symbolism of the Midwest in many ways. When politicians talk about the Midwest, they aren't talking about urban centers. And in that sense, McCaskill is right in that that's not what people conjure in their image of the Midwest. But are they ignored by the parties? I don't think so. I think that the Democratic Party relies on urban centers for large swaths of their voters in the Midwest.
Now, following this thread that kind of emerged from the debate there, and people who don't follow stuff online may have missed this. So I want to sum up a little bit. After these comments, Waleed Shaheed, a Democratic strategist, pointed to the fact that Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib of Minnesota and Michigan were also from the Midwest. And then Jonathan Wiseman in the New York Times said, hold on, saying Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar are from the Midwest is like saying Austin Representative Lloyd Doggett is from Texas and Atlanta Representative John Lewis is from the Deep South. So the idea that you're from the Midwest, but you're not the, I don't know, real Midwest, mm-hmm. that's not a phrase he used, but that's the implication a lot of people took out of that.
Yeah, I think that you're right. The implication people got was that there, when we say Midwest, we mean not these urban centers. To be fair, I think when a lot of people say Midwest, that's what they are envisioning. That's what they're thinking of. We know this both colloquially and through image, you know, through research. You know, DeVos and Banaji have a wonderful article using implicit association tests that show that American symbols are increasingly and heavily associated with whiteness. And so, yeah, absolutely, these are key components of what people are thinking of when they say Midwest. And I think that's what he was getting at. But admittedly, yes, Ilhan Omar is from the Midwest. She's from Minneapolis. There's no denying that Minneapolis is in Minnesota, which is part of the Midwest.
Now, if there's another stereotype, a quick shortcut for the Midwest and the urban Midwest in particular, okay, forget the farmland. People might be thinking Rust Belt, mm-hmm. once thriving manufacturing towns now filled with decay and closed down factories and declining populations. Mm-hmm. That's been true. That is true for some places at some times. What does that say to you about our politics that we kind of focus on that when we think of urban Midwest?
So I think what that says is that we rely on cultural stereotypes that have been perpetuated throughout the media, throughout time, right? This is the vision of the Midwest, at least the Rust Belt Midwest, has been of factories, of work, and it plays right into the American narrative, right? This American creed of hard work, working in a factory, working in a steel mill, plays right into that image of America. And so that kind of trends naturally from that. But the thing to remember is many of those cities are heavily African-American or minority. They're not all white cities.
Right. People point toward Youngstown, Ohio, mm-hmm. the idea that, okay, to win in a place like that, you need to appeal to the white working class there. And people point out, like, wait, Youngstown, for example, has a big African-American
exactly.
population.
Right. And this is part of this is that it's a function of the way that segregation has happened in urban centers in the north versus urban centers in the south. And so we look at how segregated housing and employment is in cities like Milwaukee, in cities like Detroit, and we see high levels of segregation. And so we don't see as much interaction between racial groups. And that, I think, is going to create some of this problems of what the image of, say, Youngstown, Ohio is.
Talking to Philip Chen right now, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He's with us to talk about how the Midwest fits into our political discussions and how the misconception, you see this a lot in politics, that the region is largely rural and white, ignoring a lot of the The diversity, the urban and suburban areas, doesn't tell the full story. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think people say from the coasts miss when it comes to the Midwest, whether it's culturally or politically? If you follow politics, what do you think about how the Midwest is portrayed by people running for president, people in the media reporting on the people running for president? What do you want national politicians to know about Wisconsin, about the Midwest? Call now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about how the Midwest is frequently portrayed, maybe mischaracterized by politicians and the media, looking at the area as mainly rural, mainly white. Talking to Philip Chen right now, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see the Midwest talked about in political conversations? What do you think maybe people running for president get wrong about states like Wisconsin? But what do you think about the way national media gets things wrong about Wisconsin? If you live in a rural part of the state, what do you think is missed when talking about your town, village, county? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Phil, I don't want to go through here being, oh, poor Midwest, everybody gets this wrong. I assume we have stereotypes, like if we picture California as a, I don't know, Hollywood producer in a hot tub and New York as a Wall Street executive. I don't know,
absolutely,
doing rich person things. Like, we're missing a lot there, too.
Of course. I mean, stereotypes are cognitive shortcuts, right? In the terms of psychology, right? They're a way for us to group large amounts of people into a small set of characteristics, and they rarely are accurate as far as describing all those people. So yeah, we absolutely have stereotypes about what it means to be a New Yorker, and I'm sure people from upstate New York would be dismayed at times about what we might think of in the Midwest as a New Yorker if we're thinking people who live in Manhattan. Same thing with California. You know, we think of, and California is a great example. We often think of California as sort of Southern California, LA, or, you know, San Francisco area. There's plenty of parts of California that have trended, have been consistent Republican strongholds, and they just don't sort of enter into our images of what it means to be from California.
Looking at Wisconsin in particular, we've got this situation. We've got, okay, Milwaukee County and Dane County, mm-hmm. Democrats know they've got them.
Yep.
There's the suburban counties around Milwaukee. Republicans know they've got them. Mm-hmm. And you've got counties like, what, Crawford County, some of the Southwest that had some of the biggest Obama to Trump swings
yep.
in the country. So maybe you want to swing your pitches to that place that might actually change its vote.
It's true. I mean, so this of course, is the constant debate in campaigns, right? Do you focus on persuasion, on switching people's votes, or do you focus on turnout? Do you focus on getting people that you know are going to support you to turn out? Most of the research we see now says that, by and large, elections are about turnout. It's about getting the people who you know will support you to come out and vote. And so the question, of course, is, did the, you know, southwestern portion of Wisconsin really have a lot of people who switch sides, or did just different people turn out? Did Obama just perform particularly well and get people excited and energized, and then we saw Clinton perhaps not do the same? So, you know, it's a tough causal link to draw as to whether people are switching sides or simply deactivating, getting less interested in politics, being less likely to turn out. And so that's kind of the issue. So is it about tailoring your response or your appeals to the Southwest? Maybe. Maybe it's also about spending more time in Milwaukee. We saw just as much coverage saying Clinton campaign didn't do enough in Milwaukee to turn out voters in Milwaukee County.
Is there something in our stereotypes of states because of the winner-take-all nature of a race for Senate, a race for president? If 51% votes Republican, you're a red state. If 51% votes Democrat, you're a blue state, and you ignore a lot of the nuance beneath the color.
Yeah, absolutely. That's part of it. And I think the other reason that that becomes part of this is that when we look at the coasts and the South, most of those states are solidly red or blue. Right. And so when you're talking about states that are so the Midwest becomes part of the conversation because they were the tipping point states. They were the, you know, the states that make the difference in the Electoral College, and they were close. In the same, you know, we don't talk about Republicans in California. We don't talk about Democrats in Alabama, except, of course, when Doug Jones runs, largely because those states are pretty solidly in, you know, the Democratic or Republican coalition. And so the Midwest enters into this because, one, they're the states have been fairly closely divided in recent elections, but also because they're the states that make that are sort of the tipping point states within the Electoral College.
Talking to Philip Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College, looking at national stereotypes about the Midwest, especially in political seasons. Seems like it's always political season. I know. When is it not? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want presidential candidates to know about Wisconsin, about the Midwest? What do you think people get wrong? Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. You know, part of all this seems like the performance nature of running, I guess, especially for president. You want to show that you're a regular Joe or Jill. And so you want to do, if you're in Iowa, win in Iowa, eat corn, I guess,
yep.
Or corn dogs.
Yeah. You want to go to the state fair. You want to, you know, you want to visit every county, right? These, you know, you're going to be on a bus. You're going to drive around. You do the things that you are expected to do when you are campaigning in Iowa for, you know, an early season primary. But again, Iowa especially is not particularly indicative even of the rest of the Midwest. Iowa does not have – I mean, Iowa has Des Moines. It has Council Bluffs. It has Iowa City. So it has, you know, some urban centers, but not to the same extent that, say, even Milwaukee in Wisconsin or the Twin Cities in Minnesota have real concentrations of voters in tightly packed urban areas.
Over the years, I've seen some people say that exact thing skews actual policy decisions. The fact that Iowa is so early, looms so large in presidential primaries, that you see a lot more attention paid to, like, ethanol subsidies, mm-hmm. Say, if Iowa was later in the pack, you know, that would be an issue, but it wouldn't be such a defining issue early in a presidential race.
I mean, I think it definitely skews the language that candidates are using. Whether it skews actual policymaking later on down the line, that's, I think, a little bit more, that's a much harder case to make. But absolutely, it skews what politicians talk about, right? If you, and when you start the calendar with Iowa and then New Hampshire, you're talking about two states that are not particularly racially representative. These are highly, highly white-dominated states. If you started the calendar in California and Texas, you'd get a much different view of what the candidates thought about those issues. Would it change the policies that they actually implement in the end? That's a little bit harder to prove, right? Because it's a primary versus a general. It's, you know, 11 months basically before the election, and then you've got there's just so many moving parts that it probably doesn't skew policy so much as it skews the conversation around the election.
Let's bring on a caller. Jerry is with us in Madison. Jerry, hi.
Hi. Waukesha County in Wisconsin typically turns out has a voter turnout of 90 to 95% election after election after election. And whereas the rest of the state and country has to struggle to get a 50% turnout, even in a presidential year election. And I'm just wondering, how does that work? How do they do that?
Jerry, thanks for the call. I don't know about 90s. Waukesha has high turnout.
Waukesha has high turnout.
Dane County sees, like, really what would often be seen as ridiculously high turnout numbers, too.
Yeah. I think you what you see is counties that are skewed into what we know predicts voter turnout: education, income, political engagement. These are counties that are targeted heavily by the parties that have fairly wealthy, well-educated populations. Those are the people that we know are already inclined to turn out and are very much inclined to turn out when they are targeted by the parties. And so just as Republicans know that Waukesha County is a very good stronghold for them and they're going to put effort into turning it out, Democrats know the same thing for Dane County. And so it's a confluence of factors. It's individual level factors and party targeting factors.
And again, contrary to the rural image or Rust Belt image, Waukesha County is not those two things.
Right.
It's a suburban area that I don't think people around the country think about when they think about Wisconsin.
No, I don't think they do. And that's, you know, that's the other thing we have to remember. In even within the Republican coalition in Wisconsin, the Republican coalition in Wisconsin is not simply rural Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. It's also suburban Milwaukee. Increasingly, the Republican Party is losing some of those suburbs in some states. We're not seeing it as much in Wisconsin yet, but we're seeing a shift in the Republican Party in who they're appealing to and who is turning out to vote.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line wondering why Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar isn't getting as much attention as other candidates. I mean, if people want to focus on the Midwest, there's a senator from the Midwest. I mean, Pete Buttigieg from Indiana, Midwestern, getting a little more attention. Claire McGaskill not doing so hot from Missouri. But yeah, there's a Midwestern senator not really making waves there.
There is. I mean, and it's kind of the vagaries of the party system. I mean, we're talking, 20-plus political candidates here. And you look at the candidates that are making, have the most coverage and the highest support tend to be candidates that have long-term name recognition nationally. Aside from someone like Buttigieg, who is just sort of this, has kind of spiked in support and is sort of trailing. So, it's possible that Klobuchar's time is coming to sort of have her support spike. But again, the Midwest, while important in the national coalition and the Electoral College coalition, still doesn't, when we're talking about national polls, there's still only so much, so many people who live in the Midwest. And so there's going to be some of that skewing as well.
You know, we're in the age of micro-targeted advertising. Mm-hmm. If I liked grape chewing gum, which I don't, but if I did, and marketers would know it and would sell me on it, if I'm a politician, do I want a big message that's going to appeal to everybody, or do I need to come up with a system to get those specific targets to that rural voter, that suburban voter, that urban voter?
I mean, it's a boring answer, but you want both, right?
Okay.
You want an appeal that can build your support nationally, and you want to be able to target individual voters. You want to have an enthralling platform that brings people out, and then you want to be able to take that platform and apply it directly at the micro level. That's that's what we see increasingly is not when we talk about micro targeting, we're not talking about two separate policy positions and diametrically opposed. We're talking about frames that are differently presented to these smaller groups. And that seems to be the way that we're seeing politics move and communication.
Phil, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime.
It's Philip Chen from Beloit College looking at the Midwest in the political landscape. The trade war with China has been getting hotter lately. The Trump administration announced new tariffs on almost all Chinese imports. Those would go into effect next month. Now, China has weakened its currency in part as a response to those tariffs. If you remember how it all got started, one of the administration's main reasons for the trade war was to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States. But is that actually happening? Hoyt Blakely is an associate professor of economics at the University of Michigan. Hoyt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob.
Well, I know it could be hard to measure the direct impact of things like tariffs, but what do we know about manufacturing jobs in the United States and whether they're being affected by tariffs?
Well, it depends on the industry, right? It's if it's something that competes with an import with China, then the tariffs make that a bit more competitive, but that cost gets passed on to whoever's next in the supply chain, be it another manufacturer or be it a consumer. If it's something that depends on imports from China, then its inputs just got more expensive.
What kind of industries can we look at and say, okay, yeah, maybe we are seeing job growth. It may be related to tariffs on China.
Well, steel is the obvious one, right? That steel is something that is an input to sort of many manufactured goods, but it's something that the U.S. has pushed to protect a bit more. And so that's something that has seen increase in steel prices, which, reflect eventually that those industries might scale up a little bit in the U.S. It does mean that the ones that use steel as an input might scale down.
So if I want to make something like a car or a wheelbarrow or whatever using steel, that might be hurting my job outlook.
Correct.
Now, what do we know about corporations who are facing tariffs or currently producing things in China, and whether or not they're looking at these tariffs and saying, okay, I want to move my production out of China into the United States or out of China and into a third country?
That's a really good point in your question, right, which is that you might think of the substitute for China not being somewhere in the U.S., but being Vietnam, for example. And there's certainly an awful lot of that. You might think of Asia properly as being sort of an integrated supply chain from which we buy finished goods. The finished goods might be receive their final assembly in China. Now they get their final assembly in Vietnam. That's a very likely outcome of such tariffs.
Talk about that Asian supply chain. Why do companies around the world look at that and say, yeah, I'm better off producing there, even if I'm shipping it across the Pacific Ocean?
Well, there's, 20 years ago, people started talking about the death of distance, that it was so much easier to move things, but distance is still very important. It's why the UK is a little foolish in thinking it can just extract itself from Europe because it's right next to it. So you also have a European supply chain in which German auto companies use relatively inexpensive labor from Slovenia and the Czech Republic and such. You see an integrated supply chain in North America that we know about. We in Michigan especially know about it, all the trade that goes across the river into Canada, as well as things that go down to Mexico. And, you know, there's a real natural reason, which is that heavy stuff is expensive to move a lot. And so if you're going to have a supply chain, it's inherently going to be contained to a smaller area. To the extent that those rules are exempt, interestingly enough, you might see situations like stuff that's really easy to ship, like computer code. And in fact, you see integrated supply chains in the computer industry that go between California and Bangalore, India, right, where the bits cost very little to move back and forth.
Looking at manufacturing job performance in the United States, what are we seeing when it comes to the numbers over the last couple of years?
Well, let's go back instead a couple decades, right,
sure.
where we've seen essentially decline. Some of that is because the industries where the U.S. has its sort of weakest comparative advantage, where there's a lot of labor input, those have really been hit the hardest. The industries where the U.S. has its comparative advantage are things where there's quite a bit more human capital input in the computer industry, for example. Those are the ones where the decline has been the least, or in some cases there's even been growth.
Talking to Hoyt Blakely, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Michigan, looking at trade wars, tariffs, and manufacturing job performance here in the United States. We'll bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, there's a lot of problems with the tariffs, and it obviously causes hardships and is not good, especially for the Midwest farmers. But China is obviously a bad player. They steal our intellectual property. They are definitely doing things in an unfair advantage. How else can we combat their bad behavior, if not by using these tariffs? They talked about using the TPP, but the problem is that if you're a country that's not having a lot of your intellectual property stolen, you're not going to be as concerned as the United States obviously should be.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Hoyt is a lot of people, I think, across the partisan divide think of China as a bad actor when it comes to trade. What do you think of the use of tariffs as a weapon, I guess, to get China on side?
Well, your caller asks a fantastic question, and I completely agree with the premise that there are lots of bad things that China does. I guess I disagree with the caller's implicit conclusion, right, that the way to deal with this problem is to find alliances with the countries that are the other countries that are seeing their intellectual property expropriated by China. Unfortunately, what the Trump administration has done is it's kind of burned its goodwill with many of our other trading partners that might have been advantaged by improving the protection of their intellectual property, right? It's the administration has been very aggressive in kind of going after arrangements with our friends, with the Canadians, with various of the European countries. I think there are enough countries out there that would be on our side and collectively represent a really big market that the Chinese would want to export to.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Hoyt, let's look at that Trans-Pacific Partnership. We were just touching on it there. a lot of people now are saying, yeah, to get China in line, we would need this alliance, not just the United States, but other partners that they trade with. That's what the Trans-Pacific Partnership was supposed to do. But in our 2016 election, that became toxic. Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump spoke against it. Hillary Clinton had to switch from supporting it, or decided to switch from supporting it to opposing it under a lot of pressure from key Democratic voters. What happened there?
The politics of this are a little hard for me as an economist to understand, I have to say. But clearly some kind of cooperation is indicated. And so maybe it needs to happen under different labeling. If I were to notice another recent thing that the Trump administration has done vis-a-vis trade is, you know, it came into office saying that NAFTA was the worst thing ever. And then it goes through a bunch of rigmarole and then negotiates this new thing, NAFTA 2.0, called the U.S.-Canada-Mexico Agreement, that is very, very, very similar. Don't let anybody tell you that it's a dramatic change, because it's quite similar. But it's just relabeled. Okay, so I'm going to let the politicians and their PR experts come up with a relabeling on some mechanism that lets people cooperate towards what is, I think, a reasonable end of improving, improving this situation of expropriation of intellectual property by the Chinese government.
In this trade war, if we're calling it that, with China, we've seen this recent concern with currency and China devaluing its currency. This is something people say, yeah, a decade or two ago, China did this. They kind of gamed the system with how they valued their currency. Can you untangle how this works and why it matters what China's currency is compared to the U.S. dollar?
Well, first of all, from a strategic perspective, of course they're going to try to do this in the face of tariffs, right? Because it's going to mean some of the increase in the price of their goods is going to be undone by a depreciation of their currency. That said, the dollar's been strengthening against a whole bunch of other currencies in recent times. The Chinese currency, the renminbi, is maybe different to some extent, but it's not a tremendous outlier in this dimension. There are a lot of reasons why this would happen, like their economy having, you know, record low unemployment, having tremendous deficit spending and an expansion and, you know, what is probably the peak of the business cycle. So you'd sort of expect the dollar to be becoming stronger during this period, and that's what we're getting. I wouldn't lay all of this at the feet of the Chinese.
Now, the idea of a strong dollar, you know, we like the dollar here. Being strong sounds like a good thing. How does it hurt us in some ways to have a strong dollar compared to other currencies?
Yeah, I wish we had a different expression than strong versus weak, because, you know,
now, weak sounds
so
bad.
Muscular to have a strong dollar, but of course it means our products are more expensive abroad, right? It means people have to pay higher prices for our stuff. Now, if they kept buying it anyway, we'd love it if we had a strong dollar, because it's more money coming back here. But of course, there are substitutes for U.S. products.
Do we in the United States, as the government or Federal Reserve, try to keep the dollar less strong, to try to keep the dollar weaker to make our imports or exports, sorry, more attractive?
Well, again, back to public relations, the Treasury Department has said for decades we have a strong dollar policy, but not really done that much about it and deferred to the Fed. When the Fed does things like changes interest rates, it makes investing in the U.S. more or less attractive. Recently, when it lowered interest rates, it made it less attractive to send capital to the U.S. Exchange rates are, I think people think, have this kind of mystical view of exchange rates, but they're more or less a price just like any other price that's determined in a market. If you're in an economy that is sort of letting it be flexible, and you're talking about another economy that's letting its exchange rate be flexible. And so it comes down to sort of what is the supply and demand associated with assets on either side of the border and on goods on either side of the border.
Now, as we in the United States and China escalate back and forth with tariffs and maybe changing currency, it's hurting each country in a different way. And the question seems to be, who's going to hurt less in the long run? And that side wins, I guess. What are you watching for to see who tariffs and back and forth trade battles affect worse?
Well, I guess it depends on what you think of as a win. If you think of it as a win as being unscathed, then the president's assertion via Twitter that trade wars are easy to win is just wrong. That said, China clearly depends more on trade with the U.S. than the U.S. depends on China. And so in that sense, we have kind of a negotiating advantage. On the other hand, this is someone, the president of China is essentially president for life, right? He doesn't have to answer to domestic political constituencies in the same way that our politicians do, which gives him something of a negotiating advantage. I can't say how that's going to balance out.
What are you watching for next, Hoyt, as we see this back and forth with China? What are the next steps, portents you're looking for?
I would like the tit for tat to slow down. I'd like to hear a coherent articulation of the end game from the Trump administration.
We'll leave it there. Go ahead, Hoyt.
Sounds good. No, that's great.
Hoyt, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Hoyt Blakely, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Michigan, with us today to talk about the impact of the trade war with China on American factory jobs. A new proposal introduced yesterday at the state capitol would abolish time limits for victims to report instances of alleged child sexual abuse. The Child Victims Act would also include members of the clergy as mandatory reporters of sexual abuse. Laurel White joins us now to give us a rundown of the proposed law changes. She's Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, this was released yesterday. Can you give us an overview of what all is in this proposal?
So there are two bills in this proposal, as you mentioned. One would change the statute of limitations for civil lawsuits in Wisconsin that have to do with child sexual assault. Right now, under current law, a victim can bring forward a civil action as long as they're under the age of 35. Under this proposal, that age limit would be abolished. An individual would be able to bring that challenge in civil court, no matter their age. This is a proposal that's been around the Capitol for a while. Now, the second bill is a new one. It's just introduced for the very first time during this legislative session. And that's one that would expand mandatory reporting requirements for members of the clergy. Now, they are already mandatory reporters of sexual assault, but there's a loophole, or the Democratic lawmakers that are proposing this change in legislation are calling it a loophole, that allows them to not disclose everything that they hear from members of their church.
In some cases, a private setting like the confessional, I believe in many cases, clergy are exempted from mandatory reporting. Is that accurate?
Exactly. So there's an exemption in law that says if they receive this information about sexual assault during the course of a private conversation with a member of their church, they don't need to disclose that. Now, as many folks are probably aware, a lot of the interactions that individuals have with their faith leader are in private conversations, confessionals, as you mentioned, or just other kind of private meetings. So what lawmakers said yesterday at a Capitol press conference is, you know, we are essentially excluding 99% of the conversations that clergy are having with people from these reporting requirements.
Let's look at the first part you were talking about when it comes to allowing civil suits after what is currently, I guess, the statute of limitations on them. This is something that's happened in other states. As you said, people have made the effort in Wisconsin to do that. What are their arguments for making that change?
So yesterday at this press conference, there were several victims of childhood sexual assault, and they were very consistent in making the argument that when they were children, when they experienced their assault, they either didn't feel comfortable bringing forward the accusations or they were actively discouraged from bringing forward the accusations at the time. So they said having a wider window for being able to come forward once they reach adulthood is going to allow more people to do so. They said, in particular, one woman came up and said that she believes women, once they reach their 40s in particular, are much more likely to report instances of sexual assault from their childhood just because they have a different level of maturity and a different perspective at that point in their life. Now, of course, if you're in your 40s and you want to bring a civil lawsuit over something that happened when you were underage, under current law, you wouldn't be able to do so. So essentially, they're just arguing that people shouldn't be barred from bringing forward these challenges if they reach a certain age.
Dr. Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about legislation introduced by Democrats that would change the way Wisconsin deals with child sexual abuse, making clergy mandatory reporters in all cases. Also, as we just heard, getting rid of that statute of limitations for civil suits for people who are victims as children. You mentioned, Laurel, that some victims had spoke there. You shared some of one of their comments. This is Rebecca Martin Bird talking about her experience and how she was encouraged to not report as a child. Here's a listen.
When I first told my pastor, he told me that if I told my story, it would ruin my perpetrator's life, that it would make the church look bad. And if the church looked bad, then people wouldn't come to church. And if people don't come to church, then they don't get saved.
And this is connected to a story that's just emerging this week in Wisconsin. And of course, we unfortunately, Wisconsin was at the epicenter at many points of the Catholic Church scandal. A lot of people, unfortunately, have these stories to tell, Laura.
Absolutely. So there was a news story this week that, you know, this proposal is coming out in the wake of. It was a story about child sexual assault or alleged child sexual assault at a church here in Madison, written by a reporter at the Capital Times, which is a weekly paper here in Madison. So Rebecca, that we just heard from there, was one of the subjects of that story and talked a little bit about her experience. I think just to, like, you know, flesh out her quote a little bit more, what she was saying there, kind of the end of her statement, she said, basically, when I was being discouraged from reporting, you know, they said people won't come to church. If people don't come to church, they're not going to be saved. A part that we weren't able to play there just because of constraints was she continued on and said, you know, if people aren't able to be saved, then my pastor told me they would go to hell, and if they went to hell, then it was my fault. So, you know, she said that she just felt quite a bit of guilt and pressure at the time to not come forward.
And we've got these two proposals as part of this Democratic package. What has the response been from church groups, from Republicans and others?
So I reached out to, when I did the story this week, to the Republican leaders of both the State Assembly and the Senate. Neither of them got back to me about either of these proposals. We do know that in the past, the proposal about the statute of limitations for civil lawsuits has had some pretty strong opposition from church groups in Wisconsin, both Catholic and Protestant, as well as, perhaps unexpectedly to some folks, insurance groups in Wisconsin. And that's because in civil lawsuits, sometimes the penalty put forward by the judge is a financial one. And the argument from opponents is that some of these financial penalties could be so large for some organizations that they could essentially bankrupt them.
That's an important distinction, Laurel. When we say civil suits, that is not something that puts someone in jail ultimately. It's not a criminal suit that we're talking about with a statute of limitations change.
Absolutely. There are different statutes of limitations for criminal lawsuits that have to do with child sexual assault in Wisconsin. If an alleged victim is under the age of 13, there is no limit on the time that they can report the crime. I believe if the victim is under the age of 16, the limitation for a criminal lawsuit is 45 years old.
In our last minute or so, Laurel, the legislature is not in session now. So what is the timeline for these two pieces of legislation?
So the next step for both of these pieces of legislation would be a public hearing before a committee. That's something that the sponsors said this week that they're really pushing for. They want that they want the individuals that were at the press conference to be able to come forward to share their stories in a setting in front of other lawmakers to make their case why they think this is an important proposition for the Capitol. So that would be the next step. That could happen at any time, but lawmakers aren't expected to return to the Capitol for full votes on the floor of either chamber until September or October.
And of course, briefly, Democrats in the minority in both chambers, this goes nowhere without at least some Republican support, right?
Absolutely. You would have to have some Republican votes in both chambers to get this passed.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Laurel White, State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joins us today to talk about a renewed push for the Child Victims Act by some state Democratic lawmakers. They released two pieces of legislation on that yesterday. It's zucchini season in Wisconsin. Don't be surprised to see lots of local zucchini in your grocery store, farmer's market, CSA share, or in your garden. But today you may see zucchini popping up somewhere unexpected, your own front porch. Today is National Sneak Some Zucchini Into Your Neighbor's Porch Day. It's a chance to get ahead of the zucchini glut and dump it off on someone else, an unexpected friend, family member, or neighbor. If you don't want to inflict the vegetable, technically it's a fruit, I saw, and I'm really not sure how that's defined. If you don't want to inflict it on someone else, you can tune into Food Friday tomorrow. It is all about zucchinis and what to do with them. We'll get recipes, advice on different ways, different things to make with zucchini. I have planted zucchinis this year, but not the kind that get, you know, to baseball bat size. And I planted them late, so I'm not getting hit with a glut. They're more like summer, you know, those yellow squashy-shaped summer squash things. But I pride myself every year on using almost all the zucchini I end up with. I'll bake with it. I'll saute it. I've made zucchini waffles before. That's pretty good. And of course, a lot of it goes into my famous zucchini relish. I say my, I found it online. It's a really good zucchini relish. We'll see what our guest has to offer. I guess from Bon Appetit will tell us what to do with our glut of zucchini. That's tomorrow on Food Friday. This is Central Time.